It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Many of us are still trying to make sense of what happened at last week's election. The once and future President Donald Trump always had a decent chance of winning, but it was surprising to many, including me, that he became only the second Republican to win both the Electoral College and the popular vote in the last 9 elections. And all this came after he attempted to stage a coup to keep himself in power in 2020, after he was credibly accused of assault by 28 women, after he was charged in 4 separate criminal cases, and after he was convicted of 34 counts of falsifying business records in order to cover up an affair he thought could derail his 2016 campaign. Now that Trump has been elected again, that last point, the New York fraud case, could be the only instance of Trump being held accountable to the laws that apply to every other American citizen. My next guest today was in the courtroom for that case, sitting just feet away from Trump. Jonathan Alter has documented that experience and more in his new book, American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. A Chicago native, Alter has written 5 other books on history and politics, and he's a longtime political journalist. You can read his work in New York Times Opinion and on his own Substack called Old Goats. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Jonathan, I want to get to the book because it's inextricably linked to the election outcome, but I do want to ask you about that. Have you learned anything about America that you didn't know before last Tuesday?
Yeah, I guess I have. I had suffered a crisis of faith, not in democracy, but in the good sense of what I thought was slightly less than half of the American people. And now I have to amend that and say, I would question the good sense of slightly more than half of the American people. Now, it's very important, Brian, that I make it clear that I have nothing against Trump voters personally. Because what happens is when people hear me say something like that, they go, oh, you say they're deplorable. No, I don't believe that any Trump voter is deplorable. I mean, maybe a few of them are, depending on, their behavior. But certainly the vast bulk of Trump voters are not deplorable. I respect them. I honor them as fellow human beings. I even agree with them on certain issues. I think I understand in some cases why they voted for Trump. But I reject their reasoning and think they made a bad decision, not just for their own interests, which Trump doesn't give a damn about, but for the democratic ideals on which our country was founded. So, I don't have a lot of time for people who say that if you disagree with voters, that means you're the one who has the problem, In our society, they have won. Unlike their team, we respect the will of the people, and there will be a peaceful transfer of power. But I reserve the right to say that based on my long knowledge of this man's poor character, in some cases vile character, and having watched a jury review a mountain of evidence of criminal behavior just in this one case, not even mentioning the other 50 plus indictments and cases that are now being discontinued. This man is a criminal, and it's tragic that he's just been elected president of the United States.
I have read or listened to just about every flavor of explanation of why Harris lost, from a fundamental brand problem among Democrats to racism and misogyny to the bad luck of presiding over a post-COVID economy. What explanations have you found most persuasive?
Well, I think there in a race like this, there have to be a series of explanations. I think it starts with Joe Biden. He basically said in 2016 that he would be a transitional president, and then he decided, you know, to the surprise of a lot of people, maybe I shouldn't have been one of them, but I was surprised. He made a very selfish decision in 2022 and 23 to run again for president when he was clearly too old to do so. He wasn't senile. That was just a lie that the Trump people successfully peddled. I mean, all you had to do was look at him when he hosted a NATO meeting in late June or early July, just after his disastrous debate performance. And he gave a very fluid tour of the horizon with a very subtle understanding of international relations, which he has. So he wasn't too senile to finish out his term, but it was preposterous for him to run again. And he would have left office at age 86 had he been reelected, which he would not have been. So the idea that he could, you know, win, this is a guy who, you know, he consistently finished fifth and sixth in Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary in, 1988, 2008, 2020. He's not a good politician. He's been a very good president, but he hasn't been a good politician. So the Democratic loss starts with his selfish decision to run for reelection. And then by the time they were able to swap him out in July, it was very late. And I don't really blame Kamala Harris. I think she ran generally a very good campaign. She had to build an airplane when it was in the sky. And by the way, I tell this story for the first time in American Reckoning of how Nancy Pelosi brilliantly maneuvered her off the ticket, and that if she had maneuvered Biden off the ticket, if Harris had won, this would be a major story in American history. Instead, it's now just a kind of a footnote, but a very compelling one of how Harris became the Democratic candidate. But I don't think it helped that she didn't run in any primaries, and she was anointed. That wasn't her fault. She did a terrific job of pulling things together on short notice. But it wasn't enough. And I do think that there were certain more endemic problems in the Democratic Party that hurt her, and that would start with identity politics. You know, Trump's most effective ad was she's for they, them, President Trump is for you. Now, does that mean that Democrats have to be transphobic too? They have to sell out the trans community? No, but they didn't have to be for elective sex change operations on undocumented workers who had been jailed for crimes. There's kind of a trifecta of bad stuff for Democrats. Crime.
It seems like they didn't even respond to that advertisement, which I've read is, was like $100 million. If you were in Michigan or Pennsylvania, you could not escape that ad. And I mean, one thing I've heard as a potential counter that no one used was this was actually the law during the Trump administration.
She used that counter in her interview with Brett Baer.
Well, but in advertising, in mass. Yeah,
they didn't advertise it. They didn't. They decided not to respond, and you can never not respond. And it's true that it was the law in the Trump administration. That was an okay response, but if you want to sort of Monday morning quarterback, going back a few years, the idea that Democratic interest groups would demand that kind of loyalty to an ultra progressive and politically unwise agenda, it's kind of reminiscent of the defund the police line, which you know, Democrats have been running away from for years. But the fact that they let it get out there in the first place is a sign of, you know, some kind of political malpractice. As James Carville said, you know, defund the police are the three stupidest words any Democrat has ever uttered. And, you know, the sad thing, Brian, is that if Democrats had just said reform the police, that the specifics of their proposals were identical to those of, you know, defund the police, but it's all about the framing, you know. And this is a problem that I, you know, started writing about a few years ago, that Democrats too often have led with their chins when they say things in politics, and they've, you know, catered to really quite small left-wing interest groups and not thought more broadly about the broader electorate. But I would even defend
the honor of elected Democrats here a little bit and say, you know, they're the ones not even necessarily saying this stuff. But if you have, you know, the most left-wing member of the sociology department at Columbia on Twitter, then that all gets lumped together. And how do they overcome that?
When it does, well, I mean, you'd start with, and again, I'm not blaming Kamala Harris. I thought she ran an excellent campaign. And actually, she did a lot to try to shed this identity politics. You know, I was at the convention in Chicago, and she and her people had done a great job of staying on message and stripping out stupid woke stuff from their convention. So I'm not blaming her, but she did sign that questionnaire some years ago saying that she supported elective sex change operation at taxpayer expense on prisoners, right? Many of whom were undocumented. And just to give you a sense of how deadly that was, you know, on election day, I was in Brooklyn, which is, you know, the home of some of this nonsense, to be honest about it. And all three of my kids live there. And I was walking down the street and I passed a group of Black guys who are always, they're always playing dominoes in this one part of Dean Street in Brooklyn. And as I am passing them on election day, one of them is really exercising, saying, "What the hell? I'm supposed to be paying for this criminal sex change operation? I'm a taxpayer?" You know, and that was when I realized, you know, Harris might lose. Because that message had penetrated, you know, not just in battleground states where it was all over advertising. It even penetrated in New York where there was no such advertising. You know, so Democrats just, they can't sign any dopey questionnaires anymore where they're signing something that is politically toxic.
What?
You know? But, and
yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, I agree with you that I'm not blaming a lot of Democrats who lost, like, you know, it was tragic that Sherrod Brown lost his seat. And, you know, he was subjected to a lot of these ads, a lot of them, especially in Ohio on girls sports, you know. But that's politics, and you need to do a lot of different things to protect yourself against that. And having said this, a bigger problem is disinformation. So basically, the right has set up these disinformation channels. And I write about this in American Reckoning. The book has a lot more than just the trial in it. You know, they've set up these channels of disinformation. They lie shamelessly. Demagoguery works. So a lot of people believe the lies. And, you know, we were a long way from everybody agreeing when Walter Cronkite says that's the way it is. We have these separate realities and separate series of facts. And, you know, a lot of voters didn't even know that Trump's chief of staff and top general said he was a fascist and didn't respect our war dead, thought they were suckers and losers. Those are disqualifying comments by Donald Trump. And we can sort of lament that a certain number of people heard about them and didn't care. And that's very sad. But I also think there were millions who never heard those comments because they were not on Fox. They were not on their Twitter feed. So they simply didn't know that Trump had called our war dead suckers and losers, and that this had been validated, and that he really did say it, and that it wasn't a liberal saying he said it. It was General Milley, General Kelly, former chair of the former chief of staff, and that he and General Milley, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, top military officer, believed that Trump was, quote, dangerous to our system. And that message just did not penetrate. And that's not the fault of the Democrats as much as it is the fault of this new media structure that we have in this country.
Yeah. Although Democrats are not playing in the same spaces where people, as I heard on some other commentators saying, people are getting Republican and conservative leaning messaging through this whole system of podcasts and TikToks and YouTube channels and all this stuff. And it seems like Democrats are not even really contesting a lot of that space. We need to take a break. We're going to continue with Jonathan Alter when we return. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. He is a longtime political journalist. He's written half a dozen books, the latest of which is called American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. You can also read him at New York Times Opinion and on Substack. It's called Old Goats. We're going to continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking for the rest of the program today with Jonathan Alter, the political journalist and historian. His latest book is American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. He was one of a very small number of reporters who was allowed inside the courtroom itself for the New York fraud and election interference trial of former and I guess now future president, president-elect Donald Trump. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. We heard from Franny and Hinckley, who sent us a text message today saying, sadly, too many Americans have an irrational, hostile attitude towards women, blacks, Asians, and Jews. Unfortunately, Kamala has all of the above in her baggage. The press is trying desperately to find other answers, but most Americans realize that President Biden can't change the price of eggs. I'm not so sure that most Americans realize that. Let's get a call. Yeah, let's get a call in real quick. Paul in Urbana has been waiting on line two. Paul, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I take a lot of the points that Jonathan Alter made, and I agree that the racism and sexism is all a factor. But I want to loop back to Sanders' quote about abandoning the working class. And I think that's been happening for a long time from the Democratic Party. You can go back to Clinton and his Democratic Leadership Council and Democrat. But I think something that was pivotal was during Obama's presidency, the bailing out of the banks and not remedying the problems of the people that got worked over by the banks.
Yeah.
So that's my point, and I think it's really the point that needs to be hammered more, and you can hear the response to Sanders from former Speaker of the House and everyone else, but that is really, to me, the fundamental thing. There are a lot of people that are disgusted with Trump that voted for him because they just don't see the Democrats doing much for them, and you can say, you know, what you want about the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill, but it really didn't translate into I mean, healthcare reform would be a better thing. Disadvantage. Okay, I'll listen now.
I appreciate it, Paul. Yeah, no, I mean, you made the point there. I think it was 9% of people who disapproved of Trump and voted for him anyway, according to the exit polling. Jonathan, take it where you will.
Yeah, well, I think the caller makes some really good points, and I do agree that Democrats need to do a better job of explaining everything that Biden did. So you mentioned the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill, and there's the CHIPS Act. These are major pieces of legislation. There are thousands of infrastructure projects for working class people that are underway all over the country. Unemployment is really low. So the part of the tragedy of this election is that Joe Biden, from the day he took office, got that message that the caller was delivering, and that Bernie Sanders was delivering. And Bernie Sanders was a strong supporter of Joe Biden. He understood this. What he was talking about was the accumulated damage of Democrats at least being seen to having turned their back on working people. And I think a lot of that criticism was unfair. It's rich, so to speak, coming from Republicans who, you know, the reason that Barack Obama couldn't do more for distressed homeowners during the Great Recession is the Republicans prevented him from doing so. Right. And now they're, you know, parading around as the champions of working class people when they've been basically the main impediment to Democratic efforts to help working class people over the last, you know, over the last 40 years. But they're much better at communicating, which goes to what we were talking about before the break. I mean, the Democrats did try to do things on TikTok this time, but they're way behind. And the mainstream media, which I come out of, has become in a certain way, as you know, conservatives have said for, you know, 30, 40 years, the lamestream media. Basically, we don't have any power anymore. What I write in the New York Times, sad to say, is not very relevant to any of the outcomes of these elections, nor that of any of my colleagues. So, you know, these new channels of communication are where it's at now in American politics, and Republicans do have the edge there. And it's allowed them to distort reality. And what I think is, you know, one of many alarming things looking forward, although there are also some encouraging things that we can talk about, but among the alarming things is that this good economy that Joe Biden has brought us, Trump is going to claim, and he'll probably get away with it, that the economy was terrible until he took office in 2025. And now it's great. Actually, it became great, pretty damn good, by historical basis, you know, by early this year. Having said that, I do think that elitist Democrats didn't get how powerful inflation is as a political issue. It's just a killer. You know, my last book was a biography of Jimmy Carter. It killed Jimmy Carter in 1980. Because inflation hits 100% of voters, and unemployment only hits, you know, 10%, and many of them don't vote. So inflation is just a disastrous political issue, and I blame Biden for not educating, doing more to at least try to educate people about inflation when it began hitting in 2021 and 22 and 23. You know, he should have made household words out of lines like supply chain inflation, price gouging inflation, so that Democrats would hear those back from voters and focus groups and elsewhere, and they wouldn't blame the price of eggs on Joe Biden.
I wonder, though. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I mean, given how many people were Googling on election day, did Biden drop out? I kind of wonder if any amount of messaging can really fix what's at issue here. And like you say in the book, I think the phrase you use is the sovereignty of facts. You sort of mourn the loss of when words mattered, when journalism mattered.
Yes. And this is very alarming because it's a little hard to see how we get back from this. And you know, and I'm alarmed about the future of democracy. I'm not as much alarmed by how much permanent damage this is going to do to the Democrats for two reasons. One is that all of that door knocking and phone banking, which a lot of people think, you know, wasn't relevant, actually helped save at least four Senate seats for the Democrats. So they're going to be down like 53-47 in the Senate. That is something that's not good if you're a Democrat, but it will margin will prevent some very bad things from happening. Whereas if they had been down, if, you know, Tammy Baldwin, Alyssa Slotkin, Jackie Rosen, Ruben Gallego, if they had all lost, then it would be 57-43, and it would be a very long time before the Democrats could get back into the game. So, you know, so that's one, not really a silver lining, but it's something to grab a hold of, that the Democrats, you know, are not in that deep of a hole, and midterm elections, which are mostly dominated by college-educated voters who vote Democratic. The 2026 midterms, I think, it's a little early, to say the least, but, you know, there's a very good shot of good things happening for Democrats 2 years from now. So I think Democrats should not be in despair. And, you know, what kind of makes me the most irritated at some of my fellow Democrats, Brian, is when I hear some of them talking about maybe moving out of the country. I don't think that many of them really will.
No, I feel like I've heard that since the Bush administration. People have been saying that, the second Bush administration anyway.
Yeah. This is just the kind of thing that confirms, you know, confirms right-wing attacks on, you know, weak Democrats who run from a fight. This is a fight for the future of democracy. And while everybody should use some self-care and, you know, chill a little bit before the inauguration, after that, we're all going to have to find our way to be in this fight to save our precious ideals.
All right, we only have about 4 minutes left. I do want to ask about the future, and you mentioned the midterm elections. We heard from Ann in Urbana, who asked, will Trump leave the White House after his 4-year term is up? I think once he gets there, he'll entrench himself and never leave. Thank you for that message, Ann. And I got to say, I have a friend who's a smart guy, college educated, really closely follows the news, who is very concerned about the idea that Trump may try to hold on to power somehow. The details get a little fuzzy. Like, are you actually, you know, sort of sending goon squads to take out your opponents the way they do in Russia? Are you, you know, sort of interfering with the you know, Illinois State Board of Election petition certification process? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, something like the latter is not relevant. I mean, so we have the 22nd Amendment, which was passed in the Eisenhower administration, ratified by the states, ironclad constitutional amendment. And the reason it was approved is because Franklin Roosevelt was elected 4 times, and Republicans, understandably, thought we should go back to what had been the tradition before Roosevelt, that was established by George Washington, of no more than 8 years, 2 terms. So
I hear people saying that only means what the Supreme Court is willing to say it means, and they'll point to the 14th Amendment and the Insurrection Clause. Yeah.
Yep, that's true. So I think we, because the thing with Donald Trump is every time you think he's touched bottom, he crashes through the floor. So I don't think we can underestimate him. I think he probably will want to stay. The Supreme Court is more of an open question. Yes, they made these bad decisions, and the immunity case was only one of them. But they also refused to review any of the 60 cases that Trump brought after the 2020 election. And they have rejected Trump on many occasions, on many different issues over the last 8 years. So if I had to bet, I would bet that he leaves office on January 20th, 2029. But I wouldn't bet my life on it.
Yeah, which is not something you would probably say about any of the previous office holders of President of the United States.
Unquestionably, what you say is really the saddest thing of all, is that this man was the first one to violate the peaceful transfer of power that is the foundation of our democracy, and he is an ongoing threat to our democracy, and we're about to see what it's like to have a strongman president. We've never had one in all of American history before. So this is uncharted territory, but people should not curl up in the fetal position or feel like there's nothing that can be done. And I would just remind everybody that in 2017 and 18, Trump had control of the presidency, the House, and the Senate. You can say, all right, well, he didn't quite know what he was doing. Well, they tried damn hard to abolish Obamacare, and they lost narrowly, but they lost because people organized, and you know, there was at least one person of conscience who mattered. That was John McCain, and there are other people of conscience. So the idea that he's just going to be able to get all of Project 2025 enacted, not true. He will lose on a lot of it, and it's just a question of how much people are willing to take part in a pro-democracy movement. And I have faith. You know, there's 75 million people who voted for Kamala Harris on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them will, you know, she's only going to end up losing by about 2 points.
Yeah.
And, Trump in winning is going to have gotten fewer votes than he got the last time because turnout was so much lower, which is a lot of what killed Harris's candidacy. So
we're going to have to leave it there, Jonathan Alter. I really appreciate you taking the time. The book is called American Reckoning, Inside Trump's Trial and My Own. It's about more than the trial, as he said. You learn a little bit about Jonathan's upbringing, as well as his thoughts on this year's elections. That's all the time we have for today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media.